Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. A few things to talk about. First of all, WFMU is in the midst of our 2026 fundraiser. If you're a regular listener to this podcast and want to support another year of WFMU and all that they do, I urge you to head to WFMU.org/magicbag and make a pledge right now. What is Magic Bag? Good question. I have put together a CD as a thank you gift. It is 21 artists who have all contributed original exclusive recordings to this project. I put 250 songs into a Dropbox and invited folks to cover them, bands that I loved. They all donated these tracks, and you get a CD if you pledge $75 or more. You would get a t-shirt, a subscription to our music magazine, program guide, LCD, a sticker, and of course a copy of Michael Shelley's Magic Bag, Radio Show Favorites, performed by Radio Show Favorites. It's a really great CD. If you go to that website, wfmu.org/magicbag, you see a whole list of the songs and who covered them. There's some 15 pages of liner notes you can check out, get some information, and most importantly, pledge and support WFMU and this podcast for another year. So we've got two guests today. The first is Jeannie Elfont-Festa. She is the producer of Billy Preston, That's the Way God Planned It. New documentary is playing at Monty Hall in Jersey City, March 28th, but it's playing all the way around the country in tons of theaters. Check out BillyPrestonFilm.com to see if it's playing near you. Super great movie. I cover it all in this interview. It's a short interview. Just really to promote the WFMU screening that's coming up, but I really did love the movie, and I highly recommend it. After we speak to Jeannie, we're going to hear a show from February 2007. It is an interview with Travis Wammack. He just passed away February 27th this year at age 81. Made some amazing solo recordings. Did a ton of session work in Memphis and Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Super nice guy. This is back when I was doing live interviews before I had the technology to record at home. So nowadays I kind of go a little bit longer and edit out stuff that maybe doesn't work or is redundant or whatever, dumb questions I ask. So I guess what I'm saying is I wish this was a little bit longer. If I interviewed him today, I would have made it just a little bit longer, gotten a little bit deeper, but super nice guy. We talk about some great records he worked on and interesting people he worked with. So I think you'll enjoy this. We pay a little tribute to Travis Wammack. You can check out his website, TravisWammack.com, if you're interested in more information about him. It's BillyPrestonFilm.com and it's WFMU.org/MagicBag for information about this new CD. Thank you that we've made this thank you CD project and information about how to pledge to WFMU. So here it is, me and Jeannie Elfont-Festa, and then Travis Wang. Thanks. Jeannie Elfont-Festa, welcome to the program. Good morning. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing great. I saw the movie Billy Preston, That's the Way God Planned It. I truly, truly enjoyed it. Had the volume up really loud, and it was a fantastic experience. The first question, one of the things that was very effective about the movie and I thought was very unique was how many of the folks you interviewed burst into tears in the midst of the interview. That seemed kind of unusual and very affecting and very informative about how people felt about Billy Preston.
Well, when you lose a friend, We have a lot of friends that go through situations, drug problems, family problems. They slip in and out of our lives. And those of them that we've lost, we have a little bit of, well, God, what if I said this? What if I said that? And I think that that was part of it. You know, everyone did the best they could, and everyone was just incredibly generous with their openness and their heart. So I think that's why people were so moved. I think that's why.
As an audience member, I think there's always a moment where you're saying, why didn't these people stop him? You know, they were all witnessing this stuff. And I'm not just talking about this story. I'm talking about all these sort of similar rock and roll stories. And I think it's Eric Clapton that, you know, really does wonder, should I have done something? You know, it's a kind of a chilling moment. I assume that folks were easy to persuade to be in the movie. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. People didn't want to be interviewed for sure. And then there was a subset that it was too painful for them, in meaning that they ended up being interviewed, don't get me wrong. But they, you know, it took a couple of times to just say, you're in a safe space.
What is the ratio of minutes of interviews that you shoot for a film like this versus what ends up getting used in the final cut of the film?
Oh, that is a really good question. I can't give you an exact figure. You know, we interviewed something like 51 people and 27 were in. Each interview is about 45 to an hour, sometimes more, you know, depending on how the person is feeling. Or a lot of times, you know, people sometimes are nervous, so interviews take longer because you want people to be comfortable and you want them to feel, you know, relaxed, even though they have this camera, two cameras basically on them.
It sounds like the ratio is, I don't know, 5% or something lower than that. Ringo says something like he couldn't put his hands in the wrong place. And there's a lot of instances where somebody says something and then you show examples of that in the movie, which makes it a pleasure to watch. It's nice to do a documentary of a guy like this and not somebody, a scientist or somebody who wasn't filmed as often as Billy was, because you have all this amazing footage of him. What's the earliest footage of him in the film?
He appeared in St. Louis Blues. It was a 1968 W.C. Handy biopic starring Nat King Cole, and Billy Preston played the young W.C. Handy.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, he was just born with loads of talent. So one of the great things about this movie is that you do not shy away from the hard things. In fact, it's just a movie about these hard things, mainly his sexuality and his struggles with substance abuse over the years. Mm-hmm. And I definitely appreciate that you told the truth, but tried to show sympathy and how hard it was like for his friends and band members and family. Is there a moment when you're talking about the film you want to make before it's made, where you are in a room, the principal's talking about how, you know, where the line will be, what, you know, of what we're trying to, how we will approach this? Is that something that you took a while to develop?
The first thing that you do is you get into a room and you talk about story threads. You start with timelines, you know, where they're born, basic timelines like that. Then you talk about their professional timelines. And, you know, sadly with Billy, he had a drug timelines, you know, messed up, both his personal life and his professional life. We had to cover it because, you know, if you don't cover these uncomfortable truths in one's life, you know, you've got to include a subject's complexities and their contradictions in a film. If you don't, you know, you're sanitizing what happened, and we're not going to, even as the viewer, one isn't going to learn something from it. And the answer is yes. We get into a room, we talk about all of this stuff and what, you know, the good and the bad, and we talk about how we can connect these so it's entertaining to a viewer. You have to think about that. That's our job. But also, how can we connect to a wider audience? And how can we take this and figure out a film that could portray a man with his complexities and contradictions and has the power to yet had this overwhelming sense of forgiveness? Because that's what this film is about. It's about love. It's about forgiveness. It's about accepting people for who they are. I hope people get that from the film.
I think they will, because like I said, it's handled openly, but with certainly compassion. There is some real, as you said, some real ups and downs in his life, professionally, personally.
Yeah.
For a while, he's got this ranch with horses. This is something I did not know about him. And there's great footage of him, like, you know, he's a cowboy sort of. There's lots of stuff I didn't know. Is there stuff you were surprised that you found out in the making of this movie about him that you didn't know?
You know, I've always been a really big fan. And so I always do. Every time you always discover things about yourself or about others.
There is this thing in my family where we try to invite somebody who's not in our family to Thanksgiving because it makes everyone in the family kind of behave a little bit better, and we call it the Billy Preston effect, you know? And that's, like, very evident in this film. He comes into, you know, the Beatles, and all of a sudden these guys who've been, you know, sick of each other and fighting for years and years, you know, start making music again. And some of the Beatles stuff was some of my, you know, I think it'll be some of people's real favorite parts of the film.
Oh, I'm so glad you feel that way. I'm so glad you feel that way. What I thought was amazing, actually, you know what, I'm going to just answer that other question that you asked 2 seconds ago, what surprised you the most?
Sure.
And it also goes to your point about the Billy Preston effect at your dining room table. It was Bill Maxwell who said, not only did he have perfect pitch, he had perfect anticipation for a song. Now, that I did not know, and I didn't know what it meant until we saw him walk into rooms and just all of a sudden play. And when Ringo said to us, that's exactly what happened. He literally walked into a room, and he just, that's what I meant when I say, the minute he put his hands on the keys, he just never put his hands in the wrong place. It was uncanny. So it was that moment that I was not aware of, because I thought, well, maybe he played it a few times, or maybe he knew what was going on. No, it was perfect anticipation. And like you said, the part that goes to your dinner guests is walking into a space with such big personalities of these four Beatles that each one of them holds up their own wall, right? You know, each one of them is stature. Each one of these guys are incredibly big artists. You got to walk into that and feel something. But Billy has this ability to just, for lack of a better description, not suck the air out of the room. You could witness it in that footage when he walked into that studio.
Over and over, he just has something to add musically all the time. Mm-hmm. It's pretty uncanny. Yeah. So if somebody asked me to describe the film in a sentence or so, I would say, you know, it's the story of this man. It's a mashup of his, like, charisma, his talent. It's a gripping up and down story. There's unexpected surprises, amazing musical performances. Is your takeaway any different than that?
Yeah, I mean, I would just add that this is a film that communicates Billy's journey with grace, love, and truth. And it honors him, including his complexities and his contradictions.
Yeah, you do wonder that if he had been born in a different time and didn't struggle with his sexuality, if he wouldn't have had to struggle with drugs. I mean, it's impossible to know, but it's a thought. That's a sad, mm-hmm. a sad thought. Yeah, it's playing at Monty Hall Saturday, March 28th at 4 p.m. and playing in theaters all across the country. You can go to BillyPrestonFilm.com to see if it's playing near you. It's called Billy Preston, That's the Way God Planned It. And Jeannie Elefant-Festa, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the film. I really, really enjoyed it. I thought you guys did a thorough, great job. It's fun. It's entertaining. And it, like you said, it's very thought-provoking.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Appreciate you being inviting me on the show. Thank you.
Yeah, that is Travis Wammack. Find Another Man here on WFMU. Let's start at the top of that set because we need to go over this. Clarence Carter sang the song Patches. The Osmonds did One Bad Apple. Peter and Gordon, Two Little Lovebirds. Little Richard, I Saw Her Standing There. Bobby Gentry, Fancy. And Travis Wammack there. And on the phone, Travis Wammack, welcome to WFMU.
Thank you, man. My pleasure. How y'all doing today?
I'm doing terrific. I mean, we could talk for a couple hours just about that set of music. What they all have in common is that you play guitar on every one of those songs.
Yep, I was lucky enough to just happen to be there at the right place at the right time and get to do the sessions with them great artists. It was a real pleasure playing with all of them. I had a good time. I learned a lot.
Are you one of those guys? Sometimes we talk to folks, and you know, you can talk about a number one hit record, and they say, you know, I have no memory of that whatsoever.
I can, you know, back when I was doing a lot of that recording, of course, I was young, and things didn't really, they just kind of zipped by me. But now, and I never would even listen to anything that we had recorded. But in the last couple of years, I don't know whether you could call it old age or what, but I pull out a lot of them old records and sit and listen to them, and I can remember everything that went on at the session. I mean, it's like yesterday.
That's great. I mean, I guess that's why people like music and why good music sort of stands the test of time, because it brings you right back somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned Bobby Gentry, Fancy.
Yeah.
You know, she'd have the hit record, Ode to Billy Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she came to Muscle Shoals, to Fame Studios, Rick Hall, he wanted to get the guitar sound that she used on Ode to Billy Joe, which was a little bitty Martin guitar that she played. And he asked her, he said, look, would you mind if Travis played the little Martin guitar on Fancy? He said, I want to try to capture that same guitar sound. And she said, oh, that'd be great. But this guitar was so little, it was a little bitty Martin, and it took me about an hour with my fat fingers to adjust to being able to play the notes and stuff on it. But it came off good, and it was a great song.
Yeah, Fancy is really quite a song. I mean, she was an amazing songwriter. She just churned out these great songs and these great records. What kind of a lady was she?
Very nice lady. Easy to work with. I mean, the sessions went by just great. Our biggest problem with Fancy was at the time Rick Hall had just got a four-track recorder, and he didn't know how to punch in. One of the musicians hit a bad note or something, to go back and punch it in. So we were like, we would have to cut the song all the way through, and if we messed up, go back and do it again, like the old days. So that song, it was shortened. That song was about, I want to say it was about 6 or 7 minutes long when she first wrote the thing. So it took us about 2 days to finally get that song
really
down pat.
Well, it's worth the effort. You know, we're kind of in the middle of the story here, talking about Fame and Muscle Shoals. Let's stick with this for a minute. You mentioned Rick Hall. He's the guy who started the Fame Studios, and, you know, an incredible amount of records were made in that studio, and he had a whole bunch of musicians. He would sort of seem to bring in a crew, and a year or two later, they would all quit and leave, and he would bring in another crew just as good, and the same thing would happen. What kind of guy was Rick Hall?
Well, at the start, I lived in Memphis, and he would fly me down for sessions, and he was steadily trying to get me to move down, and so finally he would bring as a matter of fact, most of the musicians that recorded the first earlier hits at Muscle Shoals were Memphis musicians.
Hmm.
All of the horn players. Then you had Tommy Cogbo, Chip Smallman. Bowlegs Miller was a trumpet player, Joe Arnold, Ed Logan, Marvell Thomas. So he finally talked me into moving down. And so at the time, his original four guys had just quit and opened up another studio in town. So I was kind of put in charge. You know, he said, hey, get me four guitar players, get me four bass players. He said, I want this studio filled up with musicians. And he said, he used to tell us, every which one comes up with the best lick gets on the session. Hmm. So it was pretty wild. Going head to head trying to come up with a better lick than the other one so they could get on the session.
And that's how those records were sort of arranged, with everybody just trying to outdo each other until you distilled it into the hit?
It was like that. And of course, usually Rick would try things. He would try recording a song backwards. I mean, just every which way in the world. But, I mean, sometimes we'd take 2 or 3 days on the song, but he would always go back to the first or second cut, which, to me, that first or second cut is when you're playing with the feel. And then after that, if he liked it, you know, then you start going back trying to copy what you did the first or second cuts. And, of course, that was... We played from the heart. We didn't read any music. We had what we call number charts that we used.
Did folks come down there with sheet music thinking something else was going to happen?
Yeah, we had I can give you an example. Lou Rawls, who was on Capitol Records, they sent him down. And we had been told that he was like one of the hardest guys in the business to work with. And I was kind of the mediator. I would go in, and Rick would let me go in and see how the guy was. Rick really couldn't. He couldn't talk to the people very much. I mean, he didn't know how to associate with them. And me, I'm just a down on country boy. I just go in and be myself. And so I asked Lou Rawls. He came in and he opened up his briefcase and he started breaking out all this music. And I said, "What are we doing?" He said, "We're going to do a tribute album to Sam Cooke. Mm. So I love Sam Cooke. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. I said, Mr. Rawls, I said, you've got all this music here. I said, are you wanting us to play this music that's on these charts here? And he said, I don't know. He said, what do you suggest? I said, well, did you come down here to get this Muscle Shoals sound that we're putting out? He said, almost definitely. And I said, well, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but you need to put that music back in that briefcase and let us just sit down here, me and you, and go over these things. And so first thing we did was bring it on home to me, and I picked up electric guitar and hit some little hot licks, and he came in singing, and the whole album came off great. He's this guy in the world to work with. He loved it. He went back and just raving about the
yeah. I've got that album. It's a fantastic album, and I know the exact lick you're talking about that starts off that song. I always thought that Lou Rawls kind of got, you know, Capitol sort of pushed him towards being more of a Tony Bennett or something when they should have had him.
Exactly, but the guy could really sing. He could get down. He could sing. He could sing that good R&B bluesy stuff.
They should have made some more soul records. So let's go back to the beginning. I mean, your first record came out, you were 11 years old?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How'd you pick up the guitar, and how'd you learn so quick?
I started playing when I was about 8 years old. My dad bought a guitar and brought it home, and come from a large family, and he brought the guitar home. He played some chords and stuff, and he said, here's a guitar, and some of y'all learn how to play it. So I picked it up, and I started learning, and I would go around. We lived in a little community in Memphis called Binghamton, and we were real poor, didn't have a lot of money, and I would go around down on it was called Broad Street. I'd go around to some of the beer joints down there with my guitar when I was like 9 and 10 years old, and I'd go in these beer joints and I'd stand by the jukebox, and somebody would come over to play the jukebox. I'd say, "What are you fixing to play?" And they'd tell me, and I said, "I know that. Can I do it for you?" And they said, "Yeah," and they put the at the time, I think it might have been a dime or something in the jukebox. They put it in my guitar, and I'd do the song. And so Eddie Bunn, a local DJ, happened to hear me one day down there, and he took an interest in me, and he started booking me on these. Back then, they called them country jamborees shows. I'd be working with Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, Warren Smith, all of the rockabilly guys. In Memphis, and I'd be opening the act at the time. They called me Little Elvis. I claimed to be the youngest first Elvis impersonator, but I was called Little Elvis a lot of times, and I did a lot of first Elvis songs and everything. And I wrote these two songs, Rock and Roll Blues, and I'm Leaving Today. So we went into a studio that was called Fernwood Studio, and I recorded that record. And at the time, the musicians, I probably had one of the best lineup of musicians on that record ever. I had I played rhythm guitar, and I had Richie Young on lead guitar, who everybody's, I'm sure, has heard of Richie. He's played on 1,800 hits, Drift Away, all that stuff, and up in Memphis, and all the Elvis Suspicious Minds. Anyway, I had him on guitar. I had Stan Kessler on bass, who became a producer of Sam the Sham, Willie Bully, and all that stuff. And my engineer was Scotty Moore.
Hmm.
Scotty was he was working with Slim Wallace, they were co-owners in the studio. And then I didn't find out until about 10 years ago, Sam Phillips published both of the songs that I had written. So a pretty good lineup for my first record.
Right. And a couple years later, you have a giant hit with Scratchy. That really shows off this sort of style you developed. Where did that style come from? I mean, how did a little kid come up with that style?
I invented it. I could not. There was nobody out there that I liked. Anything like it. And I wanted to come up with something different. And I would try everything. I mean, back then I was experimenting with everything. Of course, thank goodness to Roland James, who was also one of the great guitar players back then at Sun Records. He gave me a chance there at his studio, and he went along with anything I wanted to do. He'd go along with it, and I built me an old distortion unit out of an old record player, and I was getting that fuzz sound, and that's what I used on Scratchy.
Huh? So it's literally through an old record player, the fuzz tone on Scratchy.
An old tape recorder. Yeah. What I had done, I had plugged it into my Fender amp, and I had overloaded it, and it gave it that real bad distortion sound, which sounded good. And then on the record Stay, the instrumental Stay, I had stolen a speaker from a drive. We used to go to drive-in movies, and I'd stolen one of them old metal speakers that they hang on your window, and I hooked it up to my amp, and on Stay, that's the sound I'm using on it, which is, I mean, it's a very different sound on the guitar coming through there, but that's what it was. It was an old drive-in speaker.
I never heard of that one before. How do you go from there to playing with Peter and Gordon? We heard the Peter and Gordon cut there, Two Little Lovebirds. Now, is that a song that you wrote?
Yeah.
How did you go to backing up to...
They had heard Scratchy, and they called the booking agency that I was booking at up back in Memphis, Ray Brown. And they were fixing to do their USA tour, and they wanted my band to back them on the tour, and that's how we hooked up. I did either two or three of their USA tours with them, and got to be friends, and I let them hear some of my stuff that I was writing, and they recorded the Two Little Lovebirds and another song, My Little Girl's Gone.
And where was that stuff recorded?
That was recorded in England.
Oh, it was. Okay. And, I mean, that's a trip. I mean, coming from Mississippi and living in Memphis, and then all of a sudden you're touring, you know, the UK with these guys.
It was unreal, man, especially my first trip to New York. I didn't know how to act. I come from a poor family, and it blew my mind. Our first show in New York was a World's Fair, and it was just very, very strange to me. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine. Beatlemania, did you...
It was the same with them. They were, at the time, Peter Asher's sister, Jane Asher, was dating Paul McCartney. And they called and communicated every day, and George Harrison, I talked to him a lot. He was really impressed with my style of guitar playing, and he was wanting to know how I was doing this and how I was doing that on the guitar and everything. And we talked with them just about every day. And one of the highlights of my young career, when I turned 21 years old, my wife gave me a surprise birthday party in Memphis. And at the time, we were there for a couple of days, Peter and Gordon, and the Rolling Stones were playing the Coliseum there with the Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells. And so Peter and Gordon hooked up with Rolling Stones. They wanted to come over. So I had all these guys at my 21st surprise birthday party. We jammed all night at the club there in Memphis. And that was for a 21-year-old. Boy, my head was very big.
I wish there was a tape of that. That would be something to hear.
It would.
So you still kept putting out solo records all through the years, and eventually Rick Hall gets you to move to Muscle Shoals. And the folks who passed through the Fame Studios, you know, we're talking about Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett and Little Richard, all those folks. I mean, it's quite the cream of the crop. I mean, for a while there, everybody was sending everybody down to Muscle Shoals. I mean, why was the magic happening there?
I really, and you know, I think it was just the down the heart recording that was going on there. New York and California, Nashville, everything was pretty well, just real bland. And I think Muscle Shoals, of course, Memphis was doing the same thing, was experimenting, trying things a little different, and really just from playing from the heart and just the feel, and you know, was just unbelievable. You can take a person from the South that plays and one from the North, and they can play the same song, but it'll have a completely different feel. I don't know. I'll tell everybody, it may be in the water down here.
What about Roger Hawkins? I mean, he's the drummer on so many amazing records. You ever do sessions with that guy?
Yes.
I mean, to me, that guy is he's from another planet, you know?
Yeah, he's very, very solid. He doesn't play anymore. He's got a problem ringing in his ears and stuff, and he hadn't played in about 5 years.
That's a shame.
It is.
So the 70s come, and your association with Little Richard kind of goes into full effect, and you end up touring with Little Richard for years.
I did Richard's, the first album Richard did it after he quit rock and roll, became an ordained minister, and then he come to Muscle Shoals, and we did an album called The Real Thing. And the first time I met him, he tried to get me going on the road with him then. As a matter of fact, he stole our drummer and bass player from the studio. But I wouldn't go, and I didn't hear from him again until I think it was 1985. And he called me up, and he told me he said, Travis, he said, I'm wanting to start back doing rock and roll. Do you think rock and roll is the devil's music? And I said, Richard, when I hear Tutti Frutti, Good Golly, Miss Molly, Slipping and Sliding, I said, I think of good times. No, I don't think of the devil. He said, well, I want you to put me a good southern rock and roll band together. And he said, I'm going to start back touring. I said, okay, that's great. And so I put him the best I could find of the musicians that, I got Jesse Boas, who was a bass player that played on the Real Thing album. And then I got the horn players from here in Muscle Shoals. And my son, Monkey, Travis Jr., he was the drummer. And Chalmers Davis, keyboard player. Guy Higginbotham and Harvey Thompson, saxophone players. And so we started touring, and at the time, Richard was just kind of scuffling. He was more or less kind of like an oldie but a goodie act. But when we put this band together, the band was unbelievable.
I'll bet, yeah.
We would do the legend shows and stuff, just kick. Of course, Richard was such a talent. I mean, he was right in there with us, and it was unbelievable the performances and stuff back in. And then he got some good shots. The movie Down and Out, Beverly Hills, Great Gosh Almighty, we got to do that track, and then Arsenio Hall. Just things just really started happening for him.
You guys ended up playing for Bill Clinton's inauguration party.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you meet Bill Clinton?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is he a good old boy?
I guess so.
He didn't try to play saxophone with you, did he?
No, we thought he was going to, but he didn't make it to the our show. There was about four or five different shows going on, but he was supposed to. It was said that he may come by and jam with us.
Well, you may be better off that he didn't. And what about One Bad Apple by the Osmonds? We heard that track. I mean, how did you end up hooking up with the Osmonds?
Capitol Records sent him down to Rick Hall. They had been doing Andy Williams show for years, and so they come down, and Rick had asked me, he was looking for some good writers. Well, I had a guy that I had grew up with in Memphis, Tennessee, by the name of George Jackson, black songwriter, and I talked to George about moving down, and he said, yeah, he'd like to. So I told Rick, I said, look, George Jackson is a great black writer. I said, he may be just what you're looking for on this Osmond Sessions. He said, well, send him a plane ticket and tell him come on down. I said, well, he won't fly. He said, well, tell him I'll pay his gas. Come on down. I said, he don't drive. And so anyway, make a long story short, George came down on the Greyhound bus, and he come down and started writing. He wrote One Bad Apple and a lot of the good hits. I'll give you a story. This, him and Rick went on the outs, and George went over and started writing with Muscle Shoals Sound. Well, I had a record in the top 40 at the time that George had written called Whatever Turns You On, Do It. And George called me up. He said, Travis, I've got a song that I've written for you. He said, I think it's a hit. And he said, I think it'd be a great follow-up to Whatever Turns You On. So I told him, I said, well, come over to studio. So he come over to Fame, and we went in Fame in Studio B, and we put it down, just George on the piano singing it. And so I took it up to Rick Hall, and I let Rick Hall hear it, and he said, Travis, this ain't baloney, this is nothing. I said, so you gonna pass on it? And he said, yeah. He said, it's nothing. So they went back. You know what the song was?
No.
Old Time Rock and Roll.
Oh, big hit for Bob Seger, right?
Yeah.
Wow. And that could have been a Travis Wimmick single.
Do what?
That could have been your single?
It could have been a single. George had wrote the thing. He told me he had written it for me.
When you're a studio musician, I mean, is it you're just getting a weekly check and you never know who's going to walk in there? It could be the Osmonds. It could be.
Yeah, we get paid a union scale, union sessions, and usually I was a leader, so I would usually get double pay. But yeah, you never knew who was coming in there, and of course you know it's a challenge because you don't know what you're going to have to play, or you know you hope you can hang in there with different ones. You know, we did an album on Liza Minnelli.
Amazing. Yeah, that one I haven't dug up yet. Well, tell us what you're doing now. You're still playing gigs.
I'm still playing gigs. I've got my own label. I'm putting CDs out. I developed a fear of flying with Little Richard and had to quit him in 95. So I started my own label, Snake Man Records, and I've got about five CDs out. I've got a website, www.traviswomack.com.
And where are you based out of these days?
Muscle Shoals.
You're still in Muscle Shoals. Mm-hmm. And you're playing shows in that area, generally speaking. You ever doing any touring?
Not much. I do. I've done the Ponderosa Stomp twice, which is a 3-day thing in New Orleans. And as a matter of fact, we did it in Memphis this last year at the Gibson Factory. And just staying close to home. I do a lot of hunting. I like to hunt, and just enjoying life. I feel like I'm playing and singing better now than ever.
Well, get to New York. Would you?
I hear you, man. I've got a good buddy that's been trying to get me to come up there, Michael Lewis, who is one of the great guitar players up there, young player that plays great.
Well, get over here. We'll have you do a live session. Travis, I want to thank you. We're going to go out of here by playing Scratchy. Any comments on this song after, you know, so many years?
Well, you know, the other side I thought was going to be the A side, Firefly, because of the fast guitar playing and everything, and that was the B side. And I didn't have a lot of money, so I told the guys that played on the B side, which I thought was a B side, Prentice MacPhail on bass, guitar, and Gene Chrisman on drums. Mm-hmm. I gave them $45 a piece, and I told them, I said, I'm going to split the riders with y'all. So I ended up splitting that. What I thought was going to be the B side turned out to be the A side.
They're rich men.
But that's okay too.
That's Chauvin's. Yeah, you're right. That's a good
call. That's rock and roll.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, I hope we do get to see you soon, because you're just a real special musician and your name is on so many great records and your solo records are great and folks should check them all out.
Well, I appreciate it, man.
Sure, Travis. Have a great weekend.
Y'all have a good day.
Thanks for visiting with us.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Game out, you! We are now going to do this before!